Senate Judiciary Committee, Tuesday, May 4th, 1999, 3 p.m., room 343.
Welcome to Senate Judiciary. We'll begin with a work session on Senate Bill 1075, and I understand we have some amendments to consider that aren't ready today, conceptual type amendments, and Representative Minnis is here with the Honorable, so I will turn the gavel over to Senator Courtney if I could, because I have someone out in the hallway, but Karen, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Chair Bryant, and members of the committee. I appreciate the time the Chair has given this issue. I want to thank you, Senator Courtney, for keeping this issue alive. I'm giving it a tap-tap so we could proceed. This bill is before us because of a situation in 1996, I believe this all started. A father received custody of his daughter after being, in the judge's words, called the epitome of an abuser. She indicated that she felt the statute was not clear regarding custody and giving custody to an abuser. And so she awarded this 2-year-old child to the father, who had been arrested several times for beating his wife. So this language, this bill has come forward to try to address that situation, to make it very clear in statute that that should not, a child should not be put with somebody that has a history of beating their spouse. So that was kind of the impetus of the bill. Judge Harrell is here and wanted to speak to the issue. There are some amendments presented by Maureen McKnight that will address the rebuttable presumption part of the bill. She's stuck on the freeway. She was going to join us, and hopefully she'll get here within the next few minutes. With that, I'll just turn it over to Judge Harrell and let him go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Minnis and Senator Courtney, members of the committee. Good afternoon. I'm Stephen Harrell. I'm a circuit court judge in Multnomah County and been so for the last 18 years. For a vast majority of my career as a judge, I've spent that in the family law department and serve exclusively there at the present time. And met with this committee a couple of times already this spring. As you know, I've been quite active at the not only at the state level but the national level and in the field of juvenile and family justice, and had the honor of serving as president of the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, which is a judges membership organization devoted to family law. And the reason I mention that again is because when it comes to the amendments, it's directly related to some work that I've done with the National Council and on a committee that has come up with the approach that we're suggesting to you today. I'm here at the invitation of Representative Minnis and Senator Brown to provide whatever assistance I can on this bill. I know this committee is well aware of the devastating effects on children that come from living in a violent home and being forced to witness domestic violence. Kids who are forced to live that way learn very quickly that violence is an acceptable way to solve problems. They are at enormously high risk of committing violent offenses in the future. They teach their own kids that violence is acceptable, and the family violence, as we know, gets passed from generation to generation. Kids are sometimes intentionally or unintentionally injured in the conflict between their parents. Kids who witness this suffer from all sorts of problems, including post-traumatic stress syndrome, eating and sleeping disorders, school problems, and the like. They may get used as pawns by the abuser to exercise control over the other parent or to control custody and access once the relationship is over. For these reasons, it's clear that a parent who commits violence in the family is generally not an appropriate caregiver for children. That has been long recognized in Oregon, and is, in fact, the section that Senate Bill 1075 addresses, which is ORS 107-137, recognizes that violence by one parent against another is a factor that the court considers in a child custody proceeding. Senate Bill 1075, which is before you now, would expand that significantly, and I think that the idea that it is presenting is a good one. but we also need to take care that we don't do something that will cause unintended negative consequences. I'm going to talk briefly about a problem with the bill as it's written. I know that the committee is considering some amendments. There is one that Maureen McKnight, who's not with us, has presented, which I think deserves your particular attention. What it would do is establish a rebuttable presumption that it is not in the best interest of a child to award sole or joint custody to a parent who has committed family abuse. This is a concept that was first proposed as part of a project of the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges in which I was a major participant. The project is called Family Violence, a Model State Code, and was released in 1994. I chaired the committee that wrote the model code and brought some copies with me. I didn't have enough for each member, but I think I've distributed three, and I have another one, which I'll leave with you. But you will find that those of you who have that or have Maureen's submission, you'll find that on page 33, section 401 of the model code. This was a three-year project of the National Council, which was made possible by a $1 million grant from the Conrad Hilton Foundation. And it was really an extraordinary effort, which included participants from virtually every discipline involved with family violence, judges, prosecutors, defense lawyers, women's advocates, law enforcement, mental health, medical, National Conference of State Legislatures, National Governors Conference. Really, the list of advisors, which appears on the model code, which I handed up, is really a who's who of who's an expert in domestic violence in the United States. It's been widely distributed and approved throughout the United States and abroad. I even made a presentation in the United Kingdom last year about the model code. And so it's pretty well established. Yesterday I asked for, from the office in Reno of our Family Violence Department of the National Council, a compendium of what states have actually adopted the rebuttable presumption. And I was surprised, actually, that there are 13 states plus the District of Columbia, and without ticking them off for you, they're listed in my written testimony. It's my strong opinion that the rebuttable presumption is a better approach either than the original language of Senate Bill 1075 or the -1 amendments, and I'll give you the reasons as briefly as I can. First of all, with regard to the original language of this bill, any parent who has ever committed a violent act against a family member would, as I read the bill, be forever disqualified from having custody of a child if the matter is contested. Unfortunately, it's not at all uncommon for both parents to have a history of family violence, which, of course, would leave a judge with no apparent alternative in such a case but to deny custody to both of them. And which creates an obvious dilemma and impact, which you can well imagine. Some restraining orders, moreover, are never contested for one reason or another, and if left stand, are judgments forever, and would have the same effect. There are dozens of scenarios, and talk about them if you have questions, that a provision like that would create. Besides which, I do believe that people can and do change, and the -1 amendment, I think, is designed to address that. But I think the rebuttable presumption approach put forward by Maureen and the model code is far preferable. It says to the parties and to the court, if the abuser must bear the burden of proof that he or she is a fit custodian for a child if there is a past history of family violence. So then it becomes up to the court, and if both parents have a history like that, then the court's going to have to make a choice with due regard to the child's safety and the victim's safety and the child's best interest. I think the -1 amendment also has a fatal flaw because it more or less presumes that batterer in intervention, which I trust you've all read that, and I won't go over what that says, but it presumes that better intervention is a cure, and it's not a cure, and my authority for that is no less than the Oregon treatment providers themselves, who have adopted a state protocol through the Oregon Domestic Violence Council, firmly rejecting the idea that that it is a cure. Not that these people don't, a lot of them do good work, they do, but they make no claim that graduation from their program means that their clients won't complete a program, who have completed the program, won't repeat the violence. So I'm urging that this committee adopts a model code approach with rebuttable presumption in it that's being offered today, and I thank you for the opportunity to be here and be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Questions?
Yes. I will after Maureen testifies.
Okay. Why don't we hear from Maureen then,
please? Chair Bryant, members of the committee, I first of all apologize for my late arrival and to my Representative Minnis and the co-panelists. I'm just going to summarize what my written testimony says. Judge Harrell really hit the main points that I think my my written remarks make as well. Just two additional ones. I have a concern that the bill is drafted, frankly, would be challenged in terms of the lack of opportunity a parent would have to even make a case for why that parent might be awarded custody. The operation of a presumption in the law that doesn't allow a parent to even say, but wait a minute, there are factors here you need to consider. You can't just automatically assume that because of this one factor I never could be heard ever on the issue of custody would be challenged, and I don't know what would happen on appeal. We could end up in a worse position in terms of the state of the law, particularly given the opportunity this body has to make appropriate policy on the issue. And the other concern I have is a practical one of what backlash it would create on the scrutiny of restraining orders with such enhanced stakes given a finding of abuse. I'm concerned that judges would scrutinize and frankly deny even appropriate petitions for abuse because of concern about the consequences of the other parent never ever being able to be heard on the issue of custody. And I don't know that serves either the victims of abuse, frankly, or the alleged perpetrators that well either. So for the reasons that Judge Harrell stated, as well as what I know to be the preference of the attorneys who represent battered women throughout the state, at least in our statewide term, we really believe the rebuttable presumption approach balances the interests of victim safety and legal fairness on the issue. I have just a hand and ghost version that are attached to my amendments. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Brown.
Who owns the Dash 1 amendment? Do you know?
That was a request from our office. We just asked legislative counsel to draft something that might address the concerns. So.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And then another question.
Yes, Senator Brown.
On page 5, line 17 and 18, you talked about the preference for the primary caregiver of the child. Is that codifying case law? Is that what we're doing there? And that doesn't have anything to do with the domestic violence piece?
Chair Bryant, Senator Brown, that preference does codify case law in terms of the proponents offering. I would have to defer to Representative Minnis.
I believe that's current law. I'm not clear. Legislative counsel drafted the bill.
Chair Bryant, Representative Brown, it's helpful. The case law does not necessarily discuss that factor in the context of domestic violence. It's an independent factor.
Okay. That's what I was like. How did that fit into the overall bill?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's it.
Other questions for this panel?
When will we have the amendments?
Hopefully Friday. Is that correct?
I believe so. They've been taken down.
So I'll reschedule this for a work session on Friday. And as amendments come in, if we could provide copies to Judge Harrell so you can offer your comments again. Thomas, sorry, to come down here, you can either contact Representative Minnis, Maureen, or our staff. But we'd appreciate your editing.
Sure. Mr. Chairman,
yes.
One question for Judge Harrell. Are you satisfied with the amendments, Judge Harrell, that Maureen McKnight has proposed for this bill?
I am, yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Thanks. I think this is one
of
the
bills.
Thank you.
And
with that, then we'll close the session on 10.75.
Okay. We'll now go into a work session on Senate Bill 722 and 723. And
let's do it separately.
We'll do it separately. Okay. All right. I'll retract that. We'll go into a work session on Senate Bill 721. And before we begin, this is the first opportunity that we've had to take a look at the amended bill. And I'll have staff go through the first two. My thought is tomorrow it's scheduled again, and we'll open it up then for public testimony. And then my hope is that on Thursday we can do a work session on these bills. So with that, Anne, why don't you briefly describe Senate Bill 721?
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 721 is the bill that would require split calculation for members who serve both as a legislator and in other employment, and it specifies that the final average salary for the period of service as a legislator is would be based only on those years of service in which the member serves as a legislator. The Dash 1 amendment specifies that this applies only to persons first elected or appointed to the Assembly on or after the effective date of the Act, and that does not apply to any person who performed any period of service as a member before the effective date of the Act.
Committee, I've tried to be consistent in what we're doing with the other PERS in making it prospective rather than any retrospective effect. But the idea here is the equity and the burden argument on PERS. Legislators would receive the benefits for their PERS participation, but at the level of compensation they received while they were in PERS plus the multiplier, rather than if they then went out, unless they became a county commissioner and were a county commissioner for 8 years, the PERS as a legislature would still count. But where now, as I understand it, you average the highest salaries over a three-year period, and it relates back into all of your time in the legislature at that higher rate. Here, in the future, for future legislator people that took advantage of that, their PERS calculation would include the calculation based on what they earned as a legislator versus then what they earned as a county commissioner at a later date. That's the idea of it. Thoughts? Set it around.
Well, Mr. Chair, having put my legal career, such as it was, on hold to do this full time, I will report that my PERS balance, I started in 91, had been able to generate about $1,000 a year for the time period I've been in the legislature. And I know some of my other colleagues, this is their only job as well. Frankly, this makes it really hard to even invest in terms of tax purposes for IRA as well. So, you don't get benefits from both. So I would be extremely concerned about punishing legislators for spending time serving the public, and that's how I see this.
Well, I don't think it's a punishment. It's just, and unfortunately, as legislators are not well paid, I think we can all agree on that. But from a PERS standpoint, it's based upon your compensation as a legislator rather than what you could earn in the future doing another job in the public employment sector.
Why should we treat this employment any other? If you were employed in the DA's office as well as in another position as a public employee, I assume that would all be, you're all in PERS, so it's all calculated together. Why would we treat legislators any different than any other public employee?
Probably because the difference in what we're paid versus what other public employees are paid. As you switch from working for the district attorney's office, maybe going to work for the attorney general, you're paid a living wage in each case. That would be the rationale for the difference.
But again, these are for purposes of discussion, Senator Brown. If you could check with your caucus, I'll do the same with my caucus. There might not be any votes for this, and if so, we wouldn't bring it out of committee.
Okay.
All right. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 721 and open the work session on Senate Bill 722.
Mr. Chair, members, the -2 amendments, 722, are before you. We just received those prior to committee. And what this does is basically the -2 amendments replace the original bill, and the -2 amendments are the more comprehensive amendments that you've been discussing for the concept that you've been discussing for a few meetings now. And what this does is create a Tier 3 for post January 1st, 2000 hires. And provides that pension for those hires would be based on a formula depending on group, what membership they were in with regard to police and fire or general service employees, and in addition an annuity based on employee contributions and earnings. The first 11 sections of the bill, 10 sections of the bill, do pertain to that Tier 3 calculation. The Section 11 of the amendment would permit an employee upon retirement to withdraw the employer sum as well as the employee's contribution without loss of eligibility for insurance or the Medicare supplement that we've been discussing. Section 15 of the bill would permit the PERS board to pool local government employers. And Section 17 would permit employer participation in the variable account. And Section 19 permits cities and counties to withdraw from PERS for all hires after the effective date of the bill.
I think, too, we intended to include not just cities and counties, but
your question,
special districts and
local
public employers. So if you could make that note. Right, the two that have to stay in for keeping the system actuarially sound would be state employees and schools. Committee, if you want to look at the practical effect of this, as far as what would happen, I refer you to the letter of April 22nd, 1999 from our actuary, Mark Johnson. And in particular, on page 7 at the bottom, where it talks about the pension plus annuity method and increases the amount 1% general service and 1.35% for public service. And as you can see, then this puts us in the range of what's required under statute for meeting 50% from the retirement system. Then the additional amount for Social Security to get up to the 75% goal of what we try to do in PERS. But that's the system that the amended -2s would incorporate. Other things that it would do, it'd permit a lump sum withdrawal of the employer contribution. Right now, you can withdraw the employee lump sum, but this would allow you to withdraw the employer. Again, it's at the option of the employee when they retire. If for some reason they need the money or they want to invest it, if they can do better, they can. And this does it without loss of the Medicare premium supplement at 65. That's at $60 a month. The reason I recommend we leave that in is that we want to encourage people to take their money out if they wish. And if the $60 per month isn't there, the testimony was most people wouldn't. It was anticipated, I think, that 15 to 20% would probably take both out. This helps from the actuarial standpoint, the PERS standpoint, and the employer standpoint, because then they don't have to continue to pay the COLA that they do now. Let's hope that portion stays in the system. So that's the reason why that happens to be in the bill. It also permits the employer to participate in the variable annuity account, which they can't do now, which is part of the problem with, I think it was 80 jurisdictions having an unfunded liability that increases their contribution rate. So those are the, in generality, what this Tier 3 would accomplish. I had a question probably from you, Fred. The community colleges have asked about portability in a Tier 3, and they would like to be able to, in their recruiting, have someone be able to bring their retirement program somehow into PERS. It could be someone from out of state who withdraws from whatever system is there, or it could be someone already in state that might be, say, in the higher education or some other program and be hired by the community college. Our rule of thumb is we're not opposed to that as long as it doesn't increase a financial obligation on PERS. And I hadn't prepped you for this particular question, but what are your thoughts? I know there are a couple of bills kicking around in the building that would allow that.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Fred McDonald, the director of PERS. With regard to your first question, someone from out of state coming into the system, at the present time, there is not a feature of our system that will allow funds to be brought in from another state and placed into PERS alongside their PERS funds as they might accrue them if they did come into state. There is, as you suggest, a bill, and I don't recall the bill number, but there is a bill which would allow people to do exactly that, to bring funds into the system, into PERS, from another qualified retirement plan, and they would be accounted for separately, invested alongside the PERS funds that one would accrue if one came into the system. But there would be no other liabilities incurred from those funds coming in. For example, we would not pay a COLA on them. There would be no other expenditures from the PERS trust in any manner to augment those funds that they were brought in. So there is a bill to do that. It's being able to roll in funds from other qualified plans. Now, with regard to your second question, if there's somebody in the higher ed system presently in Oregon, and if that person chose to go to a community college, then the system is very portable in that regard because they stay in PERS, they were in PERS, and they just continue to accrue benefits in PERS. So within our state, our system is very portable in that we have most public employers as employer participants in the system.
In the first scenario, there must be some administrative cost, though, for that, isn't there?
Yes, there would be, Mr. Chairman. There would be an administrative cost, and I did not point that out. And it is included in our fiscal analysis for that, but I don't recall what it would be. But it would not be a large fiscal impact. But there would be some.
And who would pay that?
Well, that would be paid for by it would be a liability to the system, and it therefore would be paid for out of either employer contributions or investment earnings. As the two main sources of revenue into the system, those are the two sources that would be tapped for that cost.
Is it possible to have those programs that would come in pay for that cost?
Yes, it would be. It would be so that the employers who are retaining those individuals, those services of those individuals, those charges could be, or now maybe Steve can help me out.
We're going to be paid for by administrative
cost. Thank you. And paid for by the
those that have the account, we will take administrative costs prior to distribution of earnings from those members.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Steve Delaney, our legislative liaison, has just helped me out a bit here. And the administrative charges, strike what I said, would not be paid for by the employer, but would be paid for by the person who comes into the system. The administrative costs would be paid for by the individual just prior to the time that they retire.
Prior to the time they retired?
That's correct.
Each year. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, action would occur each year as earnings are prepared to be distributed to the separate rollover accounts. Administrative costs would first be determined, deducted from those earnings, and then the earnings would be distributed to those rollover accounts.
So it would be absolutely cost neutral to PERS and to not only the employee. Around in the building that would allow that.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Fred McDonald, Director of PERS. With regard to your first question, someone from out of state coming into the system, at the present time, there is not a feature of our system that will allow funds to be brought in from another state and placed into PERS alongside their PERS funds as they might accrue them if they did come into state. There is, as you suggest, a bill, and I don't recall the bill number, but there is a bill which would allow people to do exactly that, to bring funds into the system, into PERS, from another qualified retirement plan, and they would be accounted for separately, invested alongside the PERS funds that one would accrue if one came into the system. But there would be no other liabilities incurred from those funds coming in. For example, we would not pay a COLA on them. There would be no other expenditures from the PERS trust in any manner to augment those funds that they were brought in. So there is a bill to do that. It's being able to roll in funds from other qualified plans. Now, with regard to your second question, if there's somebody in the higher ed system presently in Oregon, and if that person chose to go to a community college, then the system is very portable in that regard because they stay in PERS, they were in PERS, and they just continue to accrue benefits in PERS. So within our state, our system is very portable in that we have most public employers as employer participants in the system.
In the first scenario, there must be some administrative cost, though, for that, isn't there?
Yes, there would be, Mr. Chairman. There would be an administrative cost, and I did not point that out. And it is included in our fiscal analysis for that, and I don't recall what it would be, but it would not be a large fiscal impact, but there would be some.
And who would pay that?
Well, that would be paid for by, it would be a liability to the system, and it therefore would be paid for out of either employer contributions or investment earnings as the two main sources of revenue into the system. Those are the two sources that would be capped for that cost.
Is it possible to have those programs that would come in pay for that cost?
Yes, it would be. It would be so that the employers who are retaining those individuals, those services of those individuals, those charges could be, Now maybe Steve can help me out. We're making it paid for by
the Ministry of Commerce.
Thank you. And paid for by the, you know,
by the, those that have the account, we will take the administrative costs prior to distribution from those members.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Steve Delaney, our legislative liaison, has just helped me out a bit here. And the administrative charges, strike what I said, would not be paid for by the employer, but would be paid for by the person who comes into the system. The administrative costs would be paid for by the individual just prior to the time that they retire.
Prior to the time they retired?
That's correct.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, action would occur each year as earnings are prepared to be distributed to the separate rollover accounts. Administrative costs would first be determined, deducted from those earnings, and then the earnings would be distributed to those rollover accounts.
So it would be absolutely cost neutral to PERS and to not only the employer contributions but also the earnings.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
All right. And is that similar to what we did for Oregon Health Science Universities when we allowed them to create a different retirement option a few years ago, didn't we?
No, Ms. Chairman, that is a different arrangement that Oregon Health Sciences optional retirement plan. It's considerably different from this.
Is that going to be a portability question, though?
Yes. And I think the bill that I'm talking about came out of your committee and went to Ways and Means. 326, is that right, Steve? Or?
It's 328, Mr. Chair. There's the current one dealing with portability.
Yes. And apparently your committee acted favorably on it, Dave.
I recall. But your question was as though the transfer, if community college, somebody went to work at community college, say they came out of the OSHU system and they had the other type of retirement account, is that a portability issue as far as that is concerned? Is that what your question was going to?
Well, I think if they come out of the higher ed system, that's the same PERS system, so that's not a problem.
But if they came out of OSHU, though, doesn't higher ed have another system, too, that they can talk into?
The optional retirement plan.
How would that portability?
After they went to the community college, then they would no longer be at OHSU, so they could not participate in OHSU's optional retirement plan. But they would still have that for whenever they chose to.
Just wouldn't have the portability.
That's right. That's right. And that, of course, Ms. Chairman, is true of somebody coming into the system from out of state. If they left their funds in another state's retirement system, then they would be eligible for those funds when they become eligible to retire.
Other questions for Professor Steve? Committee, I know these are just caught off the press. I haven't read them either. And so we all need to spend a little time on them. But tomorrow we'll bring this back and take some public testimony and probably ask some questions.
So, when you talk about final average salary, is that defined in here? How is that?
The final average salary, that's defined in statute. It's not defined in this statute, but it's in the current PERS statute.
That's correct.
And I think each of you got a PERS statute book. A few sessions ago, a few hearings ago. So you might bring that tomorrow. Hearings ago. Tomorrow would be a good idea to bring that too because we can go back and forth to the other sections. Other questions? Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, then we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 722 and open the work session on Senate Bill 723. And
Mr. Chair, this is the same amendment that you looked at before. The -1 amendment 723 replaced the original bill with language modifying membership of the 11-member PERS board. It maintains the 11-member total, but reformulates how that board is made up, including the addition of 3 public members to total 6, with the requirement that at least 3 of those public members have some experience in investing or pension management. And the -1 amendments are before you, and along with a summary of what the effects of those are. And the fiscal that you have on this, just in the event of any confusion, that fiscal pertains to the bill as originally drafted, not the amendments before you.
And it's important to note that with the change in the PERS board, the requirements of the PERS board members as fiduciaries and operate under the purposes of the trust and the statute don't change. They're going to still have that same responsibility. It was our thought that by having more non-PERS members, you bring in other expertise in this area and have a different point of view as they then administer the program. So any questions on that? That's another bill that will come back tomorrow.
So the implication here is that the investing by the PERS board has not been done well, or, I mean...
They don't do the investing.
Well, the managing of overseeing has not been done well.
I think what we're implying is that we feel that if you're a beneficiary of the system, that you have maybe a different perspective
slightly more myopic, again controlled by the same fiduciary principles and standards, but that a broader view would be better from someone who's not also invested in the system as a beneficiary.
Okay, that's theory.
That's theory.
In reality?
No, that's my theory. That's my reality.
I see. So
that's why I'm recommending.
Okay, counsel will try this again. That's theory, but that's your reality. And your chair can have no question. Theory and reality can come together in your chair. My question would be, in reality, is that the case that they've acted in a myopic, or there's been some kind of management or oversight, etc., that it's been done poorly or mismanagement or anything like that?
I would not accuse the existing credit board of being guilty of any mismanagement. But I think as we look at the issues we're facing today, that some of them might have bubbled to the surface sooner with a slightly different perspective.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm wondering if Senator Courtney was in here for the brief public hearing on Senate Bill 721. Had you stepped out at the time?
Just a moment ago.
Well, that dealt with the legislature in PERS, and it was interesting how the attitude changed when we talked about legislators in PERS and what their contribution or what they would have when they finished. And I think that is illustrative of what Senator Bryant is trying to say about this board, maybe. Because when you are a recipient and it affects you, sometimes you do have a more myopic view. I just noticed that there was a distinct change in sort of the perception. I'm really being serious, that because I noticed the change in attitude, what was happening with that bill is it was actually affecting the people that are sitting here. And that is what this board, you know, they're making decisions. We're not saying it's poor, it's just a different attitude, maybe.
I understand that, Tim, you said that it's just that I have a lot of thought that, well, some different factors that brought about the situation. I didn't know that the board makeup had really been a factor in that, to tell you the truth. And so that was the only point I was making. This has happened for a number of reasons, but I didn't know that the actual board makeup and the board decision had been a contributing factor. So that was the point of my question to the chair.
Good question. And maybe if the board had the different makeup, they might have handled the administration slightly different, or say, you know, we've got a problem brewing here, we need to address it with the legislature, or been more proactive in some of the issues. There's been issues, you know, on crediting and distributions and whatnot, which is an administrative procedure, and it might have brought a different point of view for us. Other comments on 723? If not, we'll close the public hearing on it, and tomorrow, if you would like to make public comment, I'm sure many of you would, we'll do it at 3, and I'd like to do it, say, between 3 and 4 to get to the other bills. If you would contact Ann, and so I can see how much time I can give to each of you. I'd also like a reaction from the Treasurer's Office, who testified before. And if you could contact Ann, then I can plan the agenda accordingly. So with that, we will now go to Senate Bill 1163 and open a public hearing. And I would invite Charlie Stone, Ray Wilkinson, and Terry Lamers forward, please.
So. So the your dog and cat thing is not going to come up before.
Thanks. Well, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for this opportunity. I'm Ray Wilkerson with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. We represent what's called industrial private forest landowners, which means the larger private forest landowners in Oregon. Senate Bill 1163 came to you from the Stream Restoration Species Recovery Committee, where it was forwarded to you unanimously. It's a fairly straightforward, short, simple bill, and we'd like to make a straightforward, short, simple statement in support of the bill. It deals with it's a liability bill. I think the best way to illustrate it is by the most frequent example, which occurs if a tree standing on a stream bank falls into a stream or river and either causes or has the potential to cause damage to property downstream. The question is, who is liable for that damage, or who is potentially liable for the potential damage? Who should be responsible for any mitigation efforts that are needed to prevent the damage? Just by way of background and why this is before you, the Judiciary Committee is not our natural habitat. We end up here about once every two sessions. And some members of the committee are not as familiar with the Forest Practices Act as the Natural Resource Committee members.
But delighted to be here today.
We are, Mr. Chairman. The Forest Practices Act requires private forest landowners to leave behind, after logging, a significant number of trees to protect public resources. Where that primarily comes up is on stream buffers. We leave roughly $35 million worth of timber behind each year on private land in stream buffers to protect water quality and to provide habitat for fish. One of the reasons to leave those trees is because they're supposed to fall down the stream, because having wood in the stream contributes to good habitat for fish. And we're not complaining about that. We think the rules are reasonable and we're willing to do that. The question has come up recently, though, however, if sometimes these trees in the stream do more harm than good because they do cause damage to downstream property and they need to be removed or something needs to be done with them. The question then is, who's responsible for that? And the purpose of this bill is to say, if the law and the rules of the state of Oregon require a private landowner to leave the tree and this situation occurs, that it is not the responsibility or the liability of the private landowner to deal with that damage or potential damage. It ought to be the responsibility of the state of Oregon. And that's what the bill does, Mr. Chairman, and we urge its support.
Thank you, Ray. Why don't we take the testimony of all three and before we move on to questions. So who'd like to go next?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Terry Lammers. I'm with the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. Ray represents the larger landowners. We represent the family forest landowners in the state. There's over 160,000 of us. And we also strongly support this bill. We're required to leave trees along riparian areas, spread throughout the harvest unit in some areas when a harvest occurs, and along scenic highways. These trees have the potential to cause problems. We think that trees that we are required to leave as a function of the Forest Practices Act should not later on cause us problems, legal problems or liability problems, and this bill will address that, and therefore we're in strong support of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'm Charlie Stone, Assistant State Forester with the Department of Forestry and the responsibility for the Protection Division. The department is also in support of the bill, particularly the purpose, given that we do require landowners under the Forest Practices Act to leave some trees and some material and for its benefit. We do, however, have a concern identified first in front of the Stream Restoration Species Recovery Committee, but because of the language of the law where it talks about any other law or rule, language says damage arising out of wildfire or applies to any injury or any other injury, our attorneys and our cost collection folks on the fire program side, which typically wouldn't have anything to do with this bill, have identified the potential for
some defense lawyering and cost collection cases to use this in an unintended way. And so we had prepared Dash 1 amendments that would add one additional subsection of the bill, making clear that these limitations on liability do not apply to any liability established under Chapter 477, where we collect costs for fire programs. I believe the proponents of the bill are in agreement with the concept. It was not intended to affect those areas, and if it's the committee's pleasure, we'd ask that you amend that into the bill to ensure that no mischief is played with fire cost collection.
And Ray, you have no objection to Dash 1?
That's right, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, none. Questions for this panel? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1163 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1163. Thank you. Sir Charno moves the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 1163. Discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Move the bill as amended, Mr. Chair.
Senator Tarno moves Senate Bill 1163 as amended to the floor due pass. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Tarno, would you carry? Thank you. We're now going to work session on Senate Bill 80. Committee, this is a bill we heard in January, and then we postponed because there are some bills coming from the House that were going to relate to this. Those bills haven't arrived yet. Still might make it here, but you know, we're trying to conclude our work on Senate bills. So why don't we, Ann, why don't you come forward, and we'll turn to Senate Bill 80. And, on that last one?
Yeah.
All right. If, without objection,
Senator Courtney would like to be recorded as an aye vote on Senate Bill 1163.
Hearing no objection, the order. All right. This bill, are there amendments to it? And are there any amendments?
No. However, I understand this bill actually allows the appointment of counsel in guardianship proceedings. And after the last hearing in January, we've gotten some calls from at least one attorney in Eugene who is interested in appointment of counsel for the respondent, I believe. Have you had a conversation with her, Ann?
Mr. Chair, for the record, first of all, my name is Ann Christian. I'm Director of Indigent Defense Services. And, Counsel, I believe that the individual, Judith Warner, was concerned more about petitioners. People who may want to be able to seek guardianship for, like, a disabled individual. Unfortunately, I've not been able to speak with Ms. Lerner. However, I can tell you that House Bill 2760, which, Mr. Chair, was the House bill that when you first had the public hearing on Senate Bill 80, you had made the decision to hold off on further action on Senate Bill 80, which I tried to detail in a letter to you yesterday. That House bill was more inclusive, more expansive than Senate Bill 80 is as far as right to counsel. And counsel to the committee, House Bill 2760, I believe, might have included more opportunity for what this attorney is concerned about. This is a very complex area of the law, I have learned, especially over the past 6 months. It's an area where at least the concept behind Senate Bill 80, which is a limited right to court-appointed counsel, obviously everyone who's involved in a guardianship proceeding might feel the need to have counsel and to have counsel appointed so they don't have to use their own funds. There have been some recent changes with guardianship law involving, for instance, in a juvenile proceeding, where it's in the best interest, one would say, of everyone for, say, the grandmother of a young baby to be awarded guardianship, where the the cases in the juvenile court as a dependency case against the mother, say if the mother is having drug problems. Senate Bill 689 last session allowed for there to actually be a guardianship hearing within the juvenile hearing. Partially what Senate Bill 80 does is give the express authority for the attorneys who currently are representing people in juvenile court to just handle that guardianship matter because it works in efficiency for the entire system, plus it winds up oftentimes with good results as in a guardianship as opposed to a dependency matter. My understanding is the SBF is appropriating funds or making funds available for petitioners who, say the grandmother in the example that I gave, who wishes to have custody or guardianship, rather, of a grandchild, that SBF is entering into contracts with attorneys to provide that petitioner with not court-appointed counsel, but with counsel that is paid for by the state. As a refresher also, since it has been quite a period of time since this bill had a public hearing, a portion of this bill is the result of a Supreme Court decision regarding the right to state paid counsel for an individual who is facing a what used to be called permanent guardianship, which effectively was a termination of parental rights. And so we also have that aspect of this bill. So I indicated Senate Bill 80 is less expansive than House Bill 2760 was and is. House Bill 2760 last Wednesday was significantly amended. House Bill 2760 no longer contains the right to court-appointed or state-paid counsel within that bill. That is has been amended out of the bill. And I'd be happy to try to answer any additional questions, Mr. Chair, that you may have or that the committee may have.
Colleague, I think you hit the high points. This is a limited right. It's in response to a case from the Court of Appeals that said in certain circumstances there needs to be an additional appointment of counsel, but it needs to be requested, and the person has to be indigent, and it has to be in the best interest of the respondent to appoint. And as I understand where the line is now drawn from the summary, the expense has been reduced, as you can see from the fiscal analysis, to $35,000 to $46,500 estimate in the next biennium. That's quite a bit less because at one time we were talking in the $175,000 range. But I think it's a responsive bill, and it's something that they're going to have to provide based on that court decision. So now we're giving the court our interpretation of what we think is required under that decision. And I think it's not only good policy, but also financially responsible to handle it in this area. Yeah.
On the financial analysis, the very next to last sentence says $250 per case. Is this a reasonable figure? Is this actually what happens? Or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, that's an excellent question, and if we had gotten into the fiscal before, I would have raised it. And if this does pass out and go to Ways and Means, I do. We will make it clear, especially since it hit the $50,000 threshold originally, for it to go to Ways and Means if the committee acts favorably. As a result of the learning process over the past 6 months on guardianship cases, it really is it's a specialty with very, very few attorneys, I've learned, and I'm kind of in the business of trying to find attorneys to offer representation in state-paid cases. I am informed that in some communities right now, the situation is the court can go ahead and appoint counsel in these matters. The problem is there's no provision for them to be paid. So in many cases, counsel are doing this pro bono right now, and that's causing a huge difficulty in some of the especially smaller courts. In talking with judges and with attorneys more, in some areas 250 will get us attorneys. In other areas, I'm talking geographical areas, I'm being told we may have to pay as much as $2,000 if we do this on an average cost per case. The guardianship cases that are inserted are kind of heard as part of the juvenile dependency case. The state of Oregon is already paying for counsel to represent the parent or the child in many, not all of those cases. Our position will be with our contract attorneys is that they will receive no additional compensation because it's really our effort to get express authority. But in the more contested cases, I was made aware of one in which the attorney fees at a reduced rate for an attorney totaled $6,000. So there's a wide variation, and it may be a little underestimated. But I don't believe, Mr. Chair, that the number of cases. The judges I have consistently talked to said it'll be about 5% of the cases, and I'm hopeful that they're correct.
With the estimated financial impact, this is one that does not have to go to Ways and Means, and I'd recommend at this point we not to do that, but send it over to the other side. Other questions for Ann? Yes.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
Didn't she just say that it was underestimated?
It could be, but based upon... think is required under that decision, and I think it's not only good policy, but also financially responsible to handle it in this manner. Yeah.
The financial analysis, the very next to last sentence says $250 per case. Is this a reasonable figure? Is this actually what happens? Or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, that's an excellent question, and if we had gotten into the fiscal before, I would have raised it. And if this does pass out and go to Ways and Means, I do. We will make it clear, especially since it hit the $50,000 threshold originally, for it to go to Ways and Means if the committee acts favorably. As a result of the learning process over the past 6 months on guardianship cases, it really is it's a specialty with very, very few attorneys, I've learned, and I'm kind of in the business of trying to find attorneys to offer representation in state-paid cases. I am informed that in some communities right now, the situation is the court can go ahead and appoint counsel in these matters. The problem is there's no provision for them to be paid. So in many cases, counsel are doing this pro bono right now, and that's causing a huge difficulty in some of the especially smaller courts. In talking with judges and with attorneys more, in some areas 250 will get us attorneys. In other areas, I'm talking geographical areas, I'm being told we may have to pay as much as $2,000 if we do this on an average cost per case. The guardianship cases that are inserted are kind of heard as part of the juvenile dependency case. The state of Oregon is already paying for counsel to represent the parent or the child in many, not all of those cases. Our position will be with our contract attorneys is that they will receive no additional compensation because it's really our effort to get express authority. But in the more contested cases, I was made aware of one in which the attorney fees at a reduced rate for an attorney totaled $6,000. So there's a wide variation, and it may be a little underestimated. But I don't believe, Mr. Chair, the number of cases. The judges I have consistently talked to said it'll be about 5% of the cases, and I'm hopeful that they're correct.
With the estimated financial impact, this is one that does not have to go to Ways and Means, and I'd recommend at this point we not to do that, but send it over to the other side. Other questions for Ann? Yes.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
Didn't she just say that it was underestimated?
It could be, but based upon LFO's review of it, they say, I think, $46,000. At the top range.
$50 a day.
Mr. Chair, could I clarify? I don't have legislative fiscal, but I do have the one that we submitted, and I apologize for the confusion, but our fiscal impact statement that we sent to Ways and Means, and I have no reason to believe they didn't adopt the numbers, and they did. Our estimate for the 1999-2001 biennium was based on a 21-month biennium, and so the $35,000 to $46,500 is based on a partial biennium. This came up during the public hearing in January. The full biennium impact, as you'll see listed in legislative officials, is $46,500 for a full biennium, up to $93,000. And so the question was, what do you look at as far as the $50,000 level for sending it to Ways and Means? And the figures under 2001-2003 would be for a full 24-month biennium, whereas the figures 35 to 46.5 under 1999-2001 presume an effective date of October 1.
Okay, but my question isn't about the full or partial biennium. My question is about how legislative fiscal figures this, and you said that the number of filings would be an accurate way of figuring it, and then additionally 5 to 10% of that number of filings are require this legal aid or whatever, and then you take $250 per case of that 5 or 10%, and that's how you get the number. But if are you saying that $250 is the average, even when you have added in? No, it isn't. No, it isn't, because I just did the math. They are taking $250 as the average case. That is not accounting for something that would be $4,000 or $2,000 or $6,000. It's taking 5 or 10% of the 1,853 filings, and then multiplying it times 250, not 2,000, not 6,000. And you have one case that's a $6,000 case, and you've just gone over the limit.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cutub, if I could. First of all, I apologize. You see, the fiscal was prepared at the time of the public hearing. It as a result of some work done on House Bill 2760, the other one that would have provided, is when I did learn of the shortage, quite frankly, of attorneys who would be willing to handle these cases. So that's what I'm trying to make clear to the committee, is I feel comfortable with the number of cases or appointments as far as an estimate, but I do believe that the $250 per case that was the basis of the original fiscal impact statement is probably low.
But it's up to you, Mr. Chair.
Well,
and Mr. Chair, if I could, this is a matter that is in the Judicial Department's fiscal plan that is before the Public Safety Ways and Means Committee, and it's before that committee, at least as what we have termed new policy packages. And I'm just trying to be upfront with the committee, and I had always assumed, quite frankly, that this would go to Ways and Means.
Well, if the estimate is under $50,000, it doesn't have to.
And this was part of the discussion, is the estimate for a full biennium, even with the amount that may be underestimated, is at least the range goes over $50,000. And I apologize for taking your time on this matter.
Sure.
Yes.
And I'm not very good at math, so I'll throw that out as a disclaimer. But the 1,853 cases was for 1 year. And if you double that for biennium, and then look at the 5% cost, you're pushing right up against where you get only $250, I believe.
And
that's just at the 5% cost.
And
if it does go a little lower, that then...
Which he just said is a
lot. Want to send it down the way?
Well, I...
We can.
Yeah.
All right. Senator Cutub moves that Senate Bill 80, if we do pass recommendation, go to Ways and Means. Discussion.
Objection? Ordered.
Thank you, and I apologize for this.
That's all right. We'll now go to a work session on Senate Bill 1206, and I'd invite Rick Vail and Howard Triplett to come forward, please.
Well, Committee, we got 115 big minutes.
We have somebody here.
Somebody will be here. I think
this is our largest.
Howard Gerstein, I don't know where he is. I'm David Bennett.
All right.
Mr. Chair, while they're getting up here, did you open the public hearing?
I did.
Okay.
This is a work session.
Okay, I just wanted to vote on 1163 while I was out. So.
All right, we'll turn the public hearing temporarily and send Bill 1206. And which one would you want?
1163.
We'll reopen for a moment Bill 1163. And without objection, Senator Brown would like to be recorded as a...
I vote
on 1163. Any objections? Recorded. We'll go back to the public work session on Senate Bill 1206-2. And if you could identify yourself and tell us what we have in these last 2 minutes.
Senator Bryant, members of the committee, my name is David Bennett. I'm a partner in the firm of Copeland, Lundy, Bennett & Wolf in Portland. I'm one of the members of the committee. We don't have a name for our committee, I guess, other than we call ourselves self-appointed, self-important. There's been, I don't know, 10 or 12 of us over the last year have been working on amendments to the Condominium Act and to the Planned Community Act, and in some sense, on the Chapter 105 and the Disclosure Act for real estate sales. We were down here a week ago, I believe, and testified on the bill. My understanding today is that we would respond to questions. If you want us to go through what these amendments are, we can do that. I believe we summarized, Barbara Kahns is with me, and she summarized the amendments to both acts. One of the things we tried to do is make the Planned Community Act and the Condominium Act some parallel, because in some projects, the election whether to use the Condominium Act or the Planned Community Act is sort of a matter of chance or a matter of something might particularly appeal to the developer in one form. Sometimes they're very, very much the same, and the associations who live in these kinds of projects have similar kinds of issues and problems, and so we tried to make them as parallel as we could. That was one of our efforts. I'm not sure what, if you want me to go through the amendments,
well,
I'd be happy to.
No, I don't think so.
Usually when we've been down here over the years, you folks go to sleep because you go, oh, who wants to hear this again? But let me just say this. Those of us who've been on the committee have been practicing homeowner association law for a very long time. What we're trying to do is simply bring stuff into compliance with what's happening nationally, identify problems that we see that occur in representing associations, representing the developers. Those of us on the committee represent a large number of both associations and developers. There are managers around the committees, lawyers involved, litigation, suing people back and forth. So there's quite a bit of tension in the last several months as to the kinds of things we ought to amend, and the people who operate in this area have been over this with a fine-tooth comb. So we feel very comfortable with what we're presenting to you.
Are there any substantive changes from your dash one to your dash two?
I don't think so.
For the record, Barbara Combs, Chair Bryant, no. We had an issue with respect to the establishment of reserves, which was not resolved with the dash ones, and it has been addressed in the dash twos. The dash twos also included a few items that were not included in the first dash one. So other than that, I don't think there was any substantive changes. The dash ones were 114 pages, and the dash twos are 115. We included one new section that on the origin title, and it was an issue with respect to clarifying that failure to comply with the Planned Community Act would not affect titles. We don't think that title companies or lenders would want to have to deal with that problem.
Well, I did read the dash ones and the summary, the points that I thought I'd be interested in. So I'm satisfied with your testimony. Does anyone have any questions on the dash two or would like him to go into more detail?
Good. Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, I might add, some of us might be here next session, and we'll remember this.
Yeah.
We should trust you.
All right. With that, the chair then would move the DAP 2 amendments to Senate Bill 1206. Discussion? Objection? Motion carries. The chair then would move Senate Bill 1206 to the floor. Do pass recommendation as amended. Discussion? Objection? Motion carries. Pardon? Senator Courtney, would you like to be recorded as an aye vote?
Yes, Mr. Chair. That's because I stayed in the room now on the whole. All my conference have made a discussion in this room, so I do not have to make you go back to the other chair.
Always a pleasure to do that. Talk carries. Yes, Senator Carries, then I could write questions? No. All right. We will now go to the work session on Senate Bill 916. And this little bill has generated a lot of interest and a lot of people talking to me in the hallways, and we have some dash amendments.
Fours and sixes.
Well, this is the granny flat issue and the definition of what should be included. So why don't we have the authors of the dash four come forward. I think that's Sean.
Sean Miller.
And the authors of the dash six. Who wants to speak to the dash six?
Cynthia?
Bill Linden's also involved in the DAS 6, and he's talking about it. Why don't we begin with the DAS 4 first?
Chair Bryant, Sharon Fleming, Barry Reagan Rental Housing Association. We have been before you before on this bill. Dash 4 is our understanding of including owner-occupied homes that would include attached accessory dwelling units be excluded from discrimination laws for the purposes of familial status and opposite gender only. We urge your support of Dash 4.
Mr. Chair, between last it added language specifying that not only is it within or attached to, but it has a common door or with dwelling in which the homeowner is.
All right. If you could identify yourself and tell us about the DAS 6.
Yes. Senator Ryan in committee. I'm Cynthia Ingebretson from the Fair Housing Council of Oregon. And Senate Bill Dash 6 or Amendment Dash 6 represents a collaboration among many partners who have been working together, the Metro Multifamily Housing Association, the Multifamily Housing Council, the Fair Housing Council of Oregon, the Community Alliance of Tenants, the Legal Aid Services of Oregon. This represents an attempt to address the fears of that were presented for the committee insofar as landlords who are renting out rooms within their homes. At the same time, it narrowly confines the impact of this bill into shared housing. The language primarily comes from the definition of roomer in the Oregon, existing definition of the Oregon Landlord Tenant Law. That's R-O-O-M-E-R, not R-U-M-O-R. And I'd be happy to address any questions about this DAS 6.
Well, let me see if I can describe the difference between the two in my mind, and correct me if I'm wrong. The definition for the DAS 4s would be basically if it's there's a common door for access, it would be exempt, and this would include if there's an outside access to, say, a second story apartment, but once you get in the house, there's maybe a doorway that can be locked that leads downstairs, that would cover it. Where the dash sixes would go to a definition of shared space.
Correct.
Which would
be listed here, where you'd have a shared, what I call, living space, whether it be a kitchen or a bathroom or some area where you, that's where the phone is and the television or whatnot, and wouldn't base the definition on whether or not there is a common doorway. Both would require that, of course, it has to be owner-occupied, correct?
Correct.
Am I correct in seeing the distinction between the two?
Sure, you are.
All right. The other distinction is that in 916, as drafted on line 7, it says familiar status or gender, and the word that's in the dash 6 is, says sex, which is the word that's used in ORS 659.00033. So,
Chair, that's correct.
So I believe we need to be consistent if we're referring to that statute as far as gender versus sex. But was there a specific purpose in the Senate Bill 916 where you said gender rather than sex?
No, there was no purpose other than we felt that was a clearer definition, a clearer word than just the word sex.
Right. But if the prohibition in the statute says sex, then we need to keep it as sex in the bill. All right. So that's the distinction. I think we should make a decision and move the bill today. Senator Brown.
I would move the dash 6 amendment.
All right. Senator Brown moves the dash 6 amendment. Discussion.
I like the dash 6 amendment, Mr. Chairman.
I do not like the dash 6 amendment.
I will oppose the dash 6 amendment.
To oppose the dash
6 amendment. I like the dash 6 amendment.
There you go. All right.
Oh, the emotion.
Senator Tarno, do you have a preference?
I prefer the fours.
Chairman, I also would like to declare a potential conflict of interest. I'm voting against my interest in this case, theoretically, but I do. I am a landlord, so I know I'm part of a class.
And lady.
I'm a land person.
Oh, no, no.
Well, I've given this more thought than I intended to by allowing this bill to be heard. And initially, I'm the one who suggested, you know, that the locking of the door still expressed the concern to me. But there are other things you can do to make sure that you have more safety from that door. Like someone pointed out, you could put a deadbolt there that would only be accessible from the living area that's occupied by the owner. And that... So that's true. But
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Which one?
Go ahead.
Thank you. As I look at the dash 6 amendment, I mean, restricting, being so narrow as to say that you have to share a toilet or a bathtub or a shower, a refrigerator, a stove or a kitchen.
Or living space.
Or, yeah. I mean, it's just dramatically... It's totally, well, obviously it's not the same thing. It does replace the bill. And it's just so narrow. I would think we'd already have this right. It's too bad if we don't. If this does not exist already, it's a shame.
I don't believe it does exist right now.
Okay. Sure. Okay. The reason why I support the dash 6 amendments over the dash 4 is that I think what we're really doing is providing basically a protected status here, protected discrimination for people's safety and well-being. And I believe if we're going to do some protected discrimination, then it really has to have an impact on people's daily lives. And I would say that sharing either a kitchen, which this would include, or, a bathroom, that's pretty intimate living quarters and that people should be able to make some type of discriminatory decisions to allow that to happen. On the other hand, when you've got a basement apartment, and I live in the Reed College area, a lot of people have basement apartments, and, they can put deadbolts. There's a whole lot of things you can do to make a physical barrier that are no different than an apartment building,
or a, you know, granny quarters or anything like that. I think what we're talking about here is allowing discrimination when people are actually living together. And if people are not actually living together, then I don't think it's okay to discriminate, frankly.
I don't see that that's what we're doing at all, but I noticed that you said that there are all kinds of things that can be done, like deadbolts and things put on doors, to your own property, to property that you own yourself. And so I think it's an issue of liberty and property rights.
Then don't rent. I mean, if you're afraid to have people living in your basement, don't rent it out. I mean, people make decisions. People make choices.
That's right, and I'd like to avail them to some better choices here. And that's what the Dash 4 amendments do, a better choice.
Let's call the roll. We haven't done that this year.
Yeah. On the Dash 6 amendment.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Fordine? Senator
Nelson? No.
Senator
Kitchell?
No.
Senator
Farno?
No.
Senator Bryant?
Chair will vote aye.
So the Dash 6 carries. Senator Brown then would move Senate Bill 916 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Call the roll again, please.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Nelson?
Aye.
Senator
Kitchell?
No.
Senator
Tordo?
No.
Chair votes aye. The motion carries. Appreciate the debate.
Thank you.
It's a tough issue.
Carry. Senator Arnold, would you carry?
Oh, I would be thrilled. Senator Arnold, I'll carry. Do you want to carry?
Okay. Senator Burdick will carry.
All right.
We have one public hearing I'd like to do first before we get into 804 and 805. So we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2257A and invite Philip Schradl
to the stand. David and I are both in the joint center, and that started at 4:30. Can you?
Sure. I think this will be our last voting one. If you need to go, I think that'll leave us four here. So we should.
Chair Bryant, members of the committee, my name is Philip Schradl. I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice, and I work in the appellate division there. And House Bill 2257 was sponsored by the Department of Justice, and I worked with Mr. Jim Nass through the House Judiciary Committee to craft what we think is the right resolution with respect to some amendments to what passed through the House, or through both houses, last legislative session with respect to stay provisions. And what Mr. Nass and I have worked out, he represents the Judicial Department in the Appellate Practice Section, the Department of Justice, we think is a very reasonable circumstance, because the last legislative session amended the provisions of Chapter 19 in rather a kind of sweeping way, and one of those amendments changed the way that the appellate court would review actions on stays by trial courts, and it changed it to an abuse of discretion standard. And this proposal, the essential component of this proposal, was to move that back to a de novo or a fresh look by the appellate court. And that means that for either party, whether you are the proponent of the stay or the opponent of the stay, you have first to go to the trial court and get that reviewed there. And then if you're unhappy with that, go forward to the appellate court. And we think it's reasonable. We hopefully will support it. It passed unanimously through the House, and we would hope that it gets support here.
Thank you. Question? Yeah, we're missing the lap bill.
Yeah, I could tell.
A little going to work session on House Bill 2257.
I move
That's what you want me to do. Senate Bill
2-2. No, House Bill.
We're still on the other bill. I'm very this is about our finance. My House Bill 2257 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
2257A engrossed.
I hate it.
To the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion, objection, or thanks. Mr. Carrier?
Sure, I'll do that.
Thank you.
I don't even know what it is, but I'll do a good job.
Let's go back for a moment then and go into work session again on Senate Bill 61916. Senator Carno.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to send notice of the money report to
the chair of the bill.
All right, then what we need to do is enable, right? So enable him to do that.
I serve notice of possible reconsideration.
What are you doing? What are you doing? Oh, Jesus, don't. Jesus, we're trying to defuse, not gonna.
All right. So, Senator Nelson then, well, without objection, changes votes to no on Senate Bill 916. And Senator Tarno and Senator Nelson have served notice of a possible minority report.
Great.
Thank you very much.
We'll
close the work session on
916. Okay.
I think I will go down.
All right, we'll deal with this in a few minutes then. I just need a public hearing on a work session on Senate Bill 804 and 805. And Francie, tell Senator Sharple, Senator Brown and I are on our way. We are needed for a quorum in the Rules Committee. I was not here to hear the testimony on this bill when it was initially heard, and everyone who testified was opposed to it. Laura Schroeder is here today to give testimony and why it should be advanced. And so Laura will take your testimony, but Senator Brown and I won't be here to take it.